Martin Amis burst onto the literary scene as the bad boy of British literature in the 1980s and 90s with novels like Money and The London Fields. For more than 40 years, he's been an intellectual, a provocateur, and a prolific author in all genres. 14 novels, two short story collections, 7 works of nonfiction. His latest book, The Rub of Time, is a collection of previously published essays with topics ranging from literary celebrity to sports, politics to poetry, all incorporating the perspective of an expat Brit living in Brooklyn. The book is published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm so glad that it brings Martin Amis to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you are you're currently on a multi-city book tour, like the one you describe in an essay. And I'm wondering if we should all stop and tell you that not everyone thinks you're marvelous. If that would help.
Yeah, that happened to me in Florida, and it was very salutary because by then I was thinking that everyone did think I was marvelous. So I was pleased to hear it, to be reminded.
Good to keep your feet on the ground, right?
Yeah.
You also described a great scene of going into a bar after a reading. What did you see there? That's kind of a fantastic story.
Well, it was a bar within a bookstore, and you could have dinner there. And everyone in the restaurant had at least one copy of one of my books. And I thought, this is the way the world should be. No one should leave the house without a copy of one of my books. I mean, it does tend to have a terrible effect on your ego. But I'm only doing a couple of cities with this book.
Right. Well, so in the essays, they span quite a breadth of time. Tell us a little bit about the process you went through in terms of going to put this together, to select them and to curate this collection.
Well, I amassed them and then got a guy who's now a friend to help sort them out and assemble them, because I'm as low-tech as it's possible to be. So he got all the pieces together and we went through them. And there wasn't a very rigorous selection process. I just slung them all in, basically, mm-hmm. and just cut out some early stuff.
Mm-hmm. There's some more recent stuff that's political, Trump-related. There were several postscripts and footnotes. Must have been challenging in terms of chasing those stories in real time that are still developing. I mean, some of those footnotes you have in there have updates that were occurring to me as I was reading. That must be, was that frustrating or something, just letting it go?
Well, it's a warning about trying to predict the future. Philip Roth called the unfolding of political events the remorseless unforeseen. Hmm. And it seems there's something in the very nature of the way, you know, history, or the rough draft of history, progresses. And whenever I venture to make a prediction, it's always instantly dismayed by events. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, all the better for history. You can't predict it.
Right.
That's what it is.
Right. So Your father comes up a lot in the book in various ways, and I think at one point you even, I think it was in one of your responses to a letter, confessed that you've already become your father in some ways. But talk about the how sort of the burden of being Kingsley Amis's son has changed, has lifted over time?
No, it's actually the other way around. But that's only because shifts in the broader culture. When I began, in the early 70s, first novel, there was a great deal of sympathy. I mean, the slightly sinister fact is that there are practically no examples of two generations of writers. There's the Dumas, mm-hmm. father and son in France, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, little examples, but I think to get a comparison going, the child must reproduce the same sort of corpus as the adult.
Mm-hmm.
And in any language, there are practically no examples. Plenty of siblings, like the Brontes, I mean, there are many examples,
sure.
of that, but it doesn't seem to carry from one generation to another. And I think that's because you've got to start when you're very young, when you're brave and stupid, and just charge in. Otherwise, you linger and get self-conscious, and then every sentence you write, I know the feeling. There are 12 reasons why you think that sentence won't do. And mm-hmm. You see not just your father, but everyone else looking over your shoulder. So you have to charge in, which I did, not with any calculation about that, but just...
Right. Now, that makes sense, because I think that the notion of self-consciousness can be very dangerous. Ovid described it as sort of the descent into Hades, that moment the artist becomes self-conscious. Is there also an element of a sort of only room in each household for one writer? Do you think that's sort of the case, as it turns out, for a lot of families, egos, ambitions?
Well, Philip Roth again said, when a writer is born into a family, that's the end of that family. And that's just with one writer. But for a while, I was part of a household that had three writers in it. My father, me, and my stepmother of 20 years, Elizabeth Jane Howard, whom I've come to admire more and more. And there was a bit of rivalry between them because they were contemporaries. I admire older writers. I don't have the time to read younger writers unless they're friends.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only way you know that a writer is worth reading is if they've stood the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only value judgment that means anything. Hmm. All the lit crit or the reviewing crit that you mm-hmm. see is just rhetorical criticism. It's just fancy ways of saying this is the sort of thing I like. And similarly, older writers tend to despise younger writers.
You said that you regretted not being more generous with praise about your stepmother's writing. Was that because she was, in fact, your stepmother?
No, it was. She bloomed very late as a writer. I mean, she was always interesting, but her five-volume sequence, The Cazalet Chronicle, is stunningly good. And she wrote it after she'd left my father. Now, I went on seeing her and being close to her, but I, as a sort of literary snob, I stopped reading her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only now, since her death, she died at 90, about 8 years ago, that I consumed The Cazalet Chronicle and was stunned by it.
Mm-hmm. I'm D.W. Gibson. I'm speaking with Martin Amis about his new collection of essays, A Rub of Time, out with Alfred Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. So tell me, why did you decide to leave the UK for the US? What made that? And you had spent time in the US before, but when you were much younger.
Yes, and frequent crosser of the Atlantic. It was purely a personal decision with my wife and me, in that my mother had just died, and we looked around and realized that her mother wouldn't live forever, although she's still going fairly strong. And her stepfather of 30 years, in fact, died while we were moving house. So it was just that kind of urgency and also a desire for change, which is very stimulating and good for a writer to get a new habitat.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the writing you do, particularly the political writing, seems very much at close range. I mean, you make, you know, a trip to Youngstown, Ohio, for instance, but there always remains something of a perspective outside of sort of the American history books, let's say. Do you think, is that something that you manage conscientiously in terms of your role as an expat as you write about these very American issues?
I have a great hunger to learn more about American history, and am doing that piecemeal, unsystematically. And it's only since living here, not just reading, but daily experience, that I realize what a rough crowd you Americans are. You've got a very violent and sinful history.
And, it's true.
And it's absolutely fascinating to see how it lingers in the present. You know, the past has a huge weight.
Right.
And even though you're a very young country, you have these tremendous historical burdens which are still with you in race, in guns. You take this individualism ideology a bit too seriously, in my view.
But also goes back to our origins, right? Colonization and the founding of our country by the obliteration of another people. And
yeah. A revolutionary war. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the reason Christopher Hitchens loved America was it was a revolution that it's the only one in history, apart from the British, which was a very quiet thing in the 17th century. It's the only one that's worked. He would second me on this, leaving great scars. You know, when the Declaration of Independence contains a really sort of breathtaking bit of hypocrisy, all men are created equal in a country that had, you know, 5 million African Americans in chattel slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And that contradiction in the ideology of America has never gone away.
No, it has not. Well, and you write about going to a black friend's house as a kid. Tell me about that. What was that like?
Well, he came to my house. I was very enamored of this black kid called Marty in Princeton, New Jersey. And I said, would you like to come to my house for tea? And he said, nah, he said, your mom wouldn't like me. And I said, why? And he said, because I'm black. And I said, truthfully, my mother won't even notice you're black. But then he asked me to his house, and I certainly noticed I was white, because there I was with his brothers and his family. Very nice evening, mm-hmm. and we played basketball in the yard and all that. But I was crushed by a sort of self-consciousness about being white, and I wondered even then, I was 10 years old, whether he felt as black as I felt white when he walked down Main Street.
Hmm.
And I'm sure he did. I mean, that was 1960.
What were the cues that made you feel so white in that experience?
Just, it was the color of my skin.
Sure.
And absolutely inescapable. Nothing you could do about it. You couldn't hide. You couldn't wash it off. And I thought, what a terrible burden this would be if it was the other way around.
Mm-hmm. So the first section of the book on politics, it has several essays about the Republican Party. Two are from the 2012 election and one is from the 2016 election. Does looking back at the candidates and the campaigns of 2012 give any warnings about what could be in the future? Not only what we experienced in 2016, but what could be in the future?
Well, yes. Even in Tampa in 2012, when Paul Ryan's speech, which was impressive, the next day I learned that it was a pack of lies. Mm-hmm. And I found out that their slogan was, there is no downside to lying. And if I could quote my son, who's been writing about Trump, my older son, he said that he gave the lie rate of Trump and said Trump punched his way through the 1,000-line barrier last August. You know, that no downside to lying seems to have carried through into the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think that a president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, couldn't survive that kind of mendacity rate, but he has.
Mm-hmm.
And with disastrous effects on our apprehension of the truth.
You write something in the book that sort of echoes something you had just said about the complexity of the American character and the problems with it. But you talked about the Democratic Party representing the mind of America while the Republican Party represents the gut. That seems true to me, and it seems somehow connected to some of the comments you just made. But unpack that a little bit. How does that ring true for you?
Well, the argument about whether you should your nominee should be the cleverest person at your disposal, the most agile, intellectually nimble, or the most average, Now, that's an argument as old as democracy. But everywhere else on Earth has decided that you wanted a president who is cleverer than everyone else. And only in America does this question about being normative, i.e. mediocre intellectually, split the nation. You know, there are still people who think, I want a president I can have a beer with. And it's interesting that the last two Republican presidents are people you can't have a beer with. George W. Bush, who's a sort of teetering alcoholic, and Donald Trump, who has never touched the stuff because it's had such an effect on his brother.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of having a beer with the president is a complete fantasy, a self-cosseting fantasy. But it's still there, and the American Republican nominee has to come across as someone not intimidating intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to be intimidated by elected leaders. I don't want the average Joe mm-hmm. in the White House.
Do you think that sort of American perspective of someone I want to have a beer with, which is something Democrats have played to as well. I remember the Henry Louis Gates incident where he had Obama had him over to the White House to share a beer. Do you think this sort of motif, if you will, is something about the American character wanting to sort of think of its society as classless?
Well, I'm sure it does. Yeah. Even to the point of having a subnormal president.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nonsense to every other developed nation.
So did you feel compelled to write about Trump, the Trump piece, at the point you realized he would in fact be the Republican candidate? That seems like when you really picked up steam writing about him.
It was when I delivered the piece, it was clear he was going to be the candidate. But I was as astonished as anyone that he won. It's a huge anomaly that and a disgrace. It'll be a badge of shame in American history that that this man was actually voted into office, losing the popular vote. But as Hillary Clinton said at one point, why aren't I 50 points ahead?
Mm-hmm.
And I went along with that. I didn't realize that Trump would be attractive to so many people, and I didn't for a moment realize that that Hillary Clinton was anathema to so many people.
Mm-hmm.
One of Trump's supporters said, but I could never trace this quote. I think it was the New York Times, but it said, "Trump may give us nuclear war, but anything's better than Hillary."
Yeah, it's just tremendous. I'd forgotten about it. I'd heard that before, and when I read that again in your essay, it blew my mind again. It just boggles the mind in terms of allegiance. Yeah.
It does. And yeah, of the two, central thermonuclear exchange and Hillary Clinton, nuclear war is the lesser evil.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it look as though it was a protest vote that went wrong.
Right.
They wanted to shake it up, but right. not this much.
Right. So what did you learn when you compared Trump's two books? You compared The Art of the Deal and Crippled in America. What was that comparison? How was it illuminating for you?
Well, it was, as I tried to show by quotation, which is the only evidence literary criticism can produce, it was clear to me that he had suffered an atrocious decline in his psychology and in his emotional range. He'd gone from, if you look at the early tapes of him being interviewed, he has a reserve, a store of irony, detachment, amusement, mm-hmm. humor mm-hmm. That has completely disappeared now.
Mm-hmm. Even with the cover, right? You talk about how he had that cover with an angry look and everyone tried to persuade him to a more smiley expression, right?
No, but that would have ignored the indignation that he felt on behalf of America. You saw that he was doing a sort of stand-up routine, I think, last night at some dinner. And he said, no one does self-deprecating humor as well as I do, not even close. So he knows what a sense of humor is, and he once had one, but he's now lost it. And to lose your sense of humor or not to have one is a grave, it's like a sort of emotional dyslexia. You shouldn't trust a humorless person with anything. Never give them a letter to post, and always escort them across the road because they're helpless.
You say that about fiction writers as well.
It's as Clive James, the poet critic, said, common sense and a sense of humor are really the same thing operating at different speeds. A sense of humor is just common sense dancing. Now, if you don't have a sense of humor, you really don't have any common sense either, as we now see.
And how does, you talk a little bit about this in the essay too, but how does Trump use words differently when he's writing, although we know he works with co-authors quite heavily, but how does he use words differently when he's writing as opposed to when he's speaking?
Well, when he's writing, he's got sub-editors clearing up after him, and ghosts. It makes, you know, there's not a grammatical howler in every subordinate clause as there is when he talks. And nowadays, it's pathetic to watch. He can hardly brawl his way out of a six-word sentence, and his reliance on repetition and, I mean, I'm far from alone in surmising that he has, you know, early brain rot, basically.
You were definitely one of the first to say this in print, it seems, with your Harper's essay.
No, Paul Krugman was the, and we're hearing it all the time now. It's a choric criticism now, but anyway, even if he can pass an IQ test, as he seemed to do a couple of months ago, this is not translating into any kind of fluency. He is sort of subnormal now.
Subnormal in the White House. So you are working on an autobiographical novel, I hear. Is this correct?
Yeah, and coming to the end of it after God knows how many years. And it's my first venture into that huge genre called life writing, which has been with us since D.H. Lawrence and now fills a great deal of the features section of newspapers, and all autobiographical novels spring from that D.H. Lawrence breakthrough in the, around 1900.
How does it feel?
I have my doubts about, severe doubts about it. The only writer who ever got anywhere with it is Saul Bellow, who's a character in my novel, named as Saul Bellow, because he, by sort of visionary strength, he seems to penetrate the universal via the individual. Now, I can't do that, and not many ever have shown that they could do it, even for a page, but he did it. And so the genre can't be dismissed. But if, as I more and more strongly feel, fiction is freedom, then when you start writing about real people, then you accept all sorts of severe limitations. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. Contra Philip Roth, I was born into a family, and the family didn't die. It wasn't the end of that family. So delicacy about other people's feelings. Also, you can't make things up. Although I've insisted on that freedom up to a certain point in this novel.
If you're going with novel, I think you still get a little bit of free rein.
Yeah, a little bit of elbow room.
Of course. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Martin Amis about his latest book, The Rub of Time, Bellow, Nabokov, Hitchens, Travolta, Trump, Travolta, we didn't even get to, Essays and Reportage, 1994 to 2017. This Wednesday, he will be speaking and signing books with writer Patrick McGrath at Rizzoli Bookstore. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Coming up, Jake Zuckerman and Sarah Jones talk about what we can all learn from the West Virginia teacher strike. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.